This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I want to be a dentist.
That's weird.
That's all I remember from that entire movie.
Now, here's your host.
Hello, this is your host, Janie Skull of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Bert to my Ernie, Daniela Fairchild.
That's a great introduction.
I know. Bert's a great one. So is Ernie, though. I don't know which one I would want to be if I had to choose.
Bert's taller.
That's true. He's got that long banana face.
He does have that going for him.
Ernie's got the big orange head, though.
So for podcast listeners, we're not just throwing that out of left field. It turned out that Sesame Street made an announcement this week or last week that Bert and Ernie are not gay.
Officially.
They're just best friends.
They just happen to live together in a New York apartment.
No marriage for them on the horizon.
No plans to go down to the courthouse. Who was your favorite Sesame Street character?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I grew up in the era of Tickle Me Elmo, so I feel like I have to just go with that.
I always liked Grover. I think he's vastly unappreciated. He's just a skinny little blue guy.
Snuffleupagus.
Overrated.
Okay.
So something that isn't overrated is this podcast. We got a great lineup today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly with our new intern, Laura Johnson. Then we're going to have Amber's Research Minute. And then we're going to wrap it up with Chris Tassoni's Dollars and Cents. So, Laura, take it away.
Thanks, Janie. This Monday, in an NCLB do-over of sorts, the Department of Education allowed Montana to reset its proficiency targets. What sort of precedent is this signaling from Washington?
I think Washington's throwing out all kinds of signals right now. It's really hard to tell what is going on. I mean, they said last week that they were going to come up with this big waiver proposal, you know, tie it to a couple of reforms and say, if you show progress on these fronts, we'll give you some NCLB waivers. And then this week they come out and Montana basically, you know, finds this loophole where they didn't reset their standards when they could have in like 2005. And now, you know, Duncan is saying, okay, well, you can do it now. You can backtrack and do it now, and we're not going to hold you accountable. I think it's very, you know, it's very wishy-washy. What do you think?
I mean, I'll agree with you that I think Duncan's waffling a lot on what he's doing here. You're hearing waivers, you're hearing, you know, you can just not follow NCLB regulations. What I'm curious about is how this is going to play out in the year or years to come, as long as it takes us to reauthorize ESEA. I feel like this is really taking teeth out of, and some of the, you know, Klein and some of the others in Congress have said that same thing. Duncan, whatever you're doing now is really hurting our own ability to negotiate and to get a reauthorized bill on the table. And I feel like these runarounds and things are really going to affect long-term reauthorization. I wonder if just sort of the federal accountability model as we know it is going to fade into oblivion.
I mean, there's definitely the element that something needs to be done at this point. You know, you have all of these schools across the country that are meeting this, you know, they're failing AYP and are in for these sanctions. And, you know, they don't deserve to fail. They really don't. So something has to be addressed. But I agree. It makes me a little nervous that we're just kind of, at this point, finding random loopholes to address this. That doesn't seem to be a very systematic way to, you know, address something from the level of the federal government. If they're really going to make these across-the-board mandates, then, and, you know, and they want them to have teeth, like you said, then, they need to address them in an across-the-board way. You can't really pick and choose what you're going to hold, you know, who you're going to hold accountable and who you're not.
It's true. Jeb Bush with his Politico piece last week or so, you know, lead or get out of the way, Duncan. And maybe that's it. You know, he really was a proponent of a waiver system that would allow for strong state accountability systems, much like the Florida system. Florida, meanwhile, this year has had 82% or so of its schools 82% of its schools fail per AYP standards. People in Florida don't necessarily care about that. They've got a strong A-through-F system. They trust it. They know it. And they're moving forward with their own state accountability sort of to AYP. So maybe, you know, that's exactly that kind of system is something that we need to be looking at.
Well, I say to question one. Okay. Question two.
So in last week's School of Thought, Andy Rotherham praised movements like New TLA, which are pushing reform from within the teachers' unions. Terry Moe, in response to Rotherham, was less enamored. Can reform unionism work?
No.
No?
No. Good. Question number two, moving on. I mean, I think Rotherham being optimistic, you know, it's a great thing to note these insurgent movements within the union, things like the New TLA group that has got 90 out of about 350 or so spots in the UTLA legislature, so to speak. And are pushing reform initiatives there. Groups like Educators for Excellence in New York are pushing for the end of LIFO and things of that nature. So you are seeing some kind of small cracks in the armor, and that's fantastic. But in terms of big deal shifts happening within the union, that's, as Mo said, that's just not where reform is going to come from.
The idea that unions will suddenly turn around and really put students first is, it just doesn't really make sense, you know, and I really don't think that's something you can hold against them. You know, unions are there to protect the interests of their members, and they're going to continue to do that because otherwise they really don't have a reason to exist. They're not an advocacy organization in terms of schools. They're an advocacy organization in terms of teachers. Now, you know, whether or not you agree with what policies they promote and, you know, how they go about that is different. But I don't think there should even be the expectation that they're going to rise up and kind of start promoting these other policies that, yeah, in a way will kind of erode their own, you know, security and their own compensation. It doesn't really make sense. The answer to me seems to be that there has to be something outside of the movement that might also include teachers, but is not going to be the organization that exists to protect teachers.
And you're even seeing that in Illinois and Chicago now. Illinois is, you know, landmark SB 7 that was heralded as being such a great collaborative initiative. And the Chicago Teachers Union president recently came out and said, we really hate it and we're all going to probably go on strike. So, you know, even after all of that kumbaya talk, you've still got a union rep snubbing their nose at pieces of reform.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really think it's going to amount to much, but good for Andrew Rotherham for being optimistic. You always got to have that that cheery perspective in education policy. Question number three.
Jay Matthews, citing research out of MIT, says that exam schools aren't all they're cracked up to be, and maybe parents shouldn't be fretting about sending their kids to elite high schools. Is he right?
No. Parents should be doing whatever they can do to get their kids into the best schools that they can get into. Yes, there may be schools that, you know, seem good or, you know, are really elite that maybe might not be the best school for a student otherwise, but largely the schools that are elite and are really hard to get into are going to provide your kid a really good education. There's no reason not to, you know, encourage your child to do well in school so that they can get into those schools. And at the same time, I think from what it seemed like, this MIT study basically just looked at, you know, SAT, AP exam. And that to me is not really, you know, these are the kids that are already topping out on those exams anyway.
Well, I mean, I think another element of this is what you're getting out of an elite school that's not necessarily just the academic rigor. Obviously, elite schools are going to have really stellar teachers, really strong academics
and really good connections, to be honest.
Right. But exactly, it's the connections that the kids will make when they want to apply to XYZ school, or the connections that they'll tap into to get their internships or their you know, first jobs out of college and that kind of stuff. It's also the arts programs and the music programs and the things that you're not going to see in such abundance at a lot of the public schools in the country that you'll see at some of the elite schools, some of the exam schools, the extra stuff that makes, you know, for that holistic, well-rounded individual, you're getting that at those schools. And that's another thing that parents are paying for. They want, you know, the safe environment. They want the, you know, happy, all-around, holistically great child, not just the AP 5 exam student.
And, you know, there's always the argument to be made that you can push kids too hard, and these, you know, these schools are very academically rigorous. You know, you don't want to exhaust a kid or stress a kid out to the point where they, you know, become depressed or, you know, or just completely overwhelmed. But I largely don't think that's the case. You know,
hang out with the Vicky Abels.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, at, you know, of all things to be concerned about, I think that should kind of be at the bottom of the list of trying too hard. All right. Well, thanks a lot for having for playing Pardon the Gadfly with us, Laura.
No problem.
Next up, we have Amber's Research Minute. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Lovely to be here with the ladies.
Mm-hmm. Ladies Week on Education Gadfly Show.
Till Chris Tessoni comes in.
Yeah, that's true.
Spoils our fun.
That's right. So, anyway, here we are. Everybody's on vacation. But us.
Yeah. So not everybody.
Yay.
Only the lucky few.
Yeah, we're saving it up.
Well, what do we have to distract us from the fact that we're not on vacation?
So
today?
I'd love to tell you I've got this wonderfully exciting story, but I mean a study, but it's a story would be better actually. this is a little dry, but you know, hey. So it's a report out by IES on how states implement their services under IDEA legislation. So, all right, let's try to make this a little more exciting. They did a 2009 survey of all 50 states and 1,200 school districts, and I'm just going to talk about the findings relative to intervention services. There's a lot of interest there in getting kids help before they're identified and labeled as special needs. So in 2004, the legislation required, or rather allowed, districts to use up to 15% of their IDEA dollars to fund intervention services. So this includes what a lot of people are interested in, which is known as response to intervention, which is really just means you monitor how kids are doing and then you intervene when they need help. A report found that 71% of districts use RTI, which is actually pretty high. Most use it in the subject area of reading and ELA, which makes sense because many folks have hypothesized that specific learning disability, which Janie and I know something about having written a report about this, is actually linked because kids can't read. So that basically they think there's a link between kids not being able to read and kids being diagnosed with SLD. So finally, 80% of districts use RTI. They say they don't use RTI money. They actually use district money. So that was kind of interesting because really RTI is kind of seen more as a general ed thing and not a special ed thing. Couple other findings, just real quickly. They now find that most people use RTI and IQ data to identify kids with disabilities, which is pretty huge because there was a big brouhaha a while back to use IQ tests to sort of rely on how a kid can learn using IQ tests, but now they're using RTI and IQ, which is probably a little bit more reliable way to do it. So anyway, it's a ton of stuff, but it's a little dry. But for people who are interested in RTI and sort of the state of special education and IDEA, we know it's not going to be, you know, reauthorized anytime soon. But they're collecting a lot of data. What's not in here, which is really disturbing. What do you think, Janie? It's our pet peeve.
Not linking it to student achievement?
Well,
funding.
Money. Yeah.
Funding.
Yeah. So,
of course, because there is no information on funding.
No information. So it's just, Janie sort of co-authored and was the lead author, rather, on a report we did, was that 3 months ago?
Probably a little longer.
Anyway, on sort of, you know, how many kids are identified in special ed and whether that's going up or down. But anyway, the one thing we ended up saying was we're just no way to link any of this information to spending. And so I actually looked up in this report, not that you guys asked me about this, but guess how much we spent on IDEA in 2010? Just random.
I have no idea.
$12.6 billion.
Yeah.
Okay. We spent $71 million on IES-sponsored research on special education. We spent $11 million on special education evaluations, yet we still have absolutely zero data on state, district, or school spending when it comes to special education.
I think it's just because it is just impossible to measure. It's also mixed up with special education, general education, so many different, you know, budgets coming in and out, and trying to draw the line between what counts going towards one kid who's in both special education and general education.
Right.
You know. That's the one interesting, not the one interesting, but one of the interesting parts of this report was the part you did mention about funding and how they're actually, you know, most states are actually using district funds to kind of support these intervention programs, and like you said, largely because in many ways it's just good teaching. It's if a student isn't doing well, you find a way to address, you know, that student's needs so that the student does better. But at the same time, it seems like states would kind of be jumping on the bandwagon of, oh, we have these funds that we can now direct towards, you know, these programs. And I'm curious as to why they're not.
Yeah, a little head scratcher.
Right, that is interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, we know that sort of the Office of Civil Rights is now going to try to collect some of these data, which is kind of interesting too. But I mean, I guess, you know, we should just be happy that some of the spending data are going to be collected, and, you know, we'll have to hold off our skepticism until those reports come out.
So what song do we have to go along with our skepticism and our lack of funding?
So this is exciting. I'm hoping you guys know the Santa Claus claymation cartoon, not that it's anywhere near Christmas. So since we're talking about intervening with students early, we have Put One Foot in Front of the Other from the Santa Claus special.
I really am a mean and despicable creature at heart, you know. It's so difficult to really change?
Difficult? Why, look here. Changing from bad to good's as easy as taking your first step. Put one foot in front of the other, and soon you'll be walking across the floor. Put one foot in front of the other, and soon you'll be walking out the door. You never will get where you're going if you never get up on your feet. Come on, there's a good tailwind blowing. A fast walking man is hard to beat.
Put one foot in front of the other, and soon you'll be walking across the floor. Put one foot in front of the other, and soon you'll be walking out the door.
I want to be a dentist.
It's weird.
That's all I remember from that entire movie.
There was the Abominable Snowman. We were
the
debating
the Island of Misfit Toys.
Yeah, we were debating in the interlude here whether or not Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was actually part of it or not.
Yeah, I definitely have very vivid memories of Rudolph, but can't remember really the connection of movies.
If they're all made out of clay, they're probably all from that same film.
Yeah, or same genre at least. So now, on a different topic, we have Chris here for Dollars and Cents.
This is Dollars and Cents, where we
make sense
of education finance.
A poet once said, "More money, more problems." Few district superintendents can sympathize with Biggie Smalls on this point, however. Most are struggling to balance their budgets without cutting services. Earlier this week, the New York Times highlighted some schools whose leaders are taking a smart approach to reducing costs by greening their schools to reduce energy usage. Cutting back on excessive energy use makes sense for education leaders looking to trim fat rather than muscle. Schools are energy-intensive places, and they're not usually known for their frugality. One school district on Long Island has taken to employing an energy cop, an assistant principal who patrols the hallways and tickets teachers who waste power, for instance by leaving computers on overnight. This is a good first step to getting teachers to police themselves about energy usage, but it doesn't go that far. Even better are districts that use stimulus money or state loans to replace older boilers and light fixtures with newer, more efficient models. Dan Last, the education practice manager for AtSight, a DC-based sustainability company, tells me that these renovations often pay for themselves quickly by saving big bucks on energy bills. These small infrastructure improvements can make a big difference going forward, especially if energy costs continue to rise. With green buildings growing in popularity, there's a nice opportunity here for entrepreneurial school leaders. There are legions of green startups, sustainability MBAs, and environmental science grad students out there who are looking for projects to work on. Find one, get to work looking for savings, and ask your district leaders if you can keep half of what you save to invest in programs for kids.
This is actually an uplifting dollars and cents for once.
Yeah, usually school money is pretty dismal and downbeat.
Yeah.
But so that's a good point. You know, how many nonprofits are actually out there to speak specifically to schools who are really trying to go in and appraise what is working energy-wise, what's not, you know, how many windows would need to get replaced, what the cost of that would be, what the overall savings would be after 10 years. You know, is anyone doing kind of a diagnostic like that for schools?
There's a small but growing number of organizations, both nonprofit and for-profit, that are targeting this space. So AtSight, as I mentioned, here in D.C., and the New York Times article mentions a couple in New York that are also targeting schools. So it's a growing space.
That's fair. I mean, I've read this Times article. It was insane to me, the amount of money that some of the districts saved, upwards of, you know, $500,000 a year in just turning off the lights when the kids left the classroom.
Yeah, often these are buildings that were built in the 60s or before, and the policies around turning lights off, turning computers off, have just not caught up to the private sector, which actually has done a good job of trying to reduce these kinds of costs as energy prices have gone up.
Yeah, rarely is there actually an option that, you know, immediately shows, you know, saved money. It just seems like it's a simple option if you actually have the money to be able to invest in the first place.
And then, yeah, it's an easy way.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to www.edexcellence.net and sign up to receive the original Education Gadfly in your inbox. Till next week.
I'm Daniela Fairchild.
And I'm Janie Skull of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.